Sitting here in Jerusalem with Rabbi Joseph Schoenwald. I knew you, Joseph, at one point as a congregational rabbi in California, and now since you've come to Jerusalem, you've been doing something else. Could you tell us a little about what you've been doing here?
Well, I'm onto my act two. My first act was 25 years in the American pulpit. And since our coming to Jerusalem, my family and I, my wife and three daughters, I've had the, privilege of managing the Israel side interests of the Rockland Foundation. The Rockland Foundation is headquarters in Reno, Nevada. And they have engaged me for the last several years to be involved in bringing social welfare programs to the former Soviet Union, as well as several very important immigrant and social welfare programs here in Israel.
I know you've worked also with the Ethiopians, and at one point I read a story about your traveling to an obscure Ethiopian area called Kara, I think it was, and the last part of your trip was on a tractor. Could you tell us a little about that, what that was like to go back there and what the people are like in the place?
Well, if you're referring to Kora was a very interesting area of Ethiopia. It's an area which was isolated, and because of its isolation, the Jews who were in Kwara were neglected and basically were forgotten there when Operation Solomon and Moses took place. These Jews were so far away from the place from where the Jewish agency collected them that they didn't hear of the possibility of leaving and going to Israel, and it took several years for us to find them, locate them, and tell them that that their brethren who were living a three-day march on the highlands had already departed. So that was back in the late 80s and early 90s, when we had the wonderful privilege of going back and finding them and finding that they had been left behind, and coalescing them and getting them ready to come to Israel. On the waning day of the Benjamin Netanyahu cabinet, was one of the last actions that government took, which is to bring in the Jews of Kwara, some 5,000 souls, on those waning days of his regime.
What other interesting things would you like to share with us about the immigrants that you've worked with?
Well, our work, the work of the Rockland Foundation, takes me to the former Soviet Union, and we have been positioned in Russia since before Perestroika. It started out with bringing Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz to teach clandestinely Torah to refusnikim, to those who have been refused exit, some Jewish activists, and then culminating with the establishing of the first institute of rabbinic learning in the post-perestroika period in Moscow. But our activity really centered around the elderly and children. It started out some 25 years ago with matzahs at a time when there wasn't any. It continued with food for the aged and the poor, and the establishment of what we call the Chasadim centers, which were multi-purpose and multi-delivery systems for the elderly and the Jews of the communities that have no longer had any more communal structures. Of course, today all that is history, because the Chasadim have are found in almost every major city, as well as in the periphery of both Russia and the Ukraine and the Asiatic states. They grew from several Chasadim to some 300-400 of them that are established today. From there, food is arranged for the elderly, warm meals, food packages are sent to the indigent and those who are closed in. From there, health services are provided, some vocational rehabilitation, but primarily the most important aspects of needs that concerns the poor, food, clothing, medical services, and then providing a warm house atmosphere, which was the antecedents of creating a Jewish community in the post-Soviet era.
Does your organization take a stand on Aliyah? Are you interested in these people coming to Israel, or should they remain where they are and develop Jewish communities again, still in the diaspora?
Well, interesting you should ask that, Yoram, because it's a question that comes up again and again. It's a fair question. I believe that that these Jews should be sustained wherever they are. And even though it might be cheaper to establish someone in Russia where there are not much, but some social services that are provided and some form of pension which are provided, albeit too small and not enough to sustain, these people have had apartments in most parts, and so to bring him to Israel is a very costly proposition, which requires housing and the myriads of social services which are needed to support and sustain them. So while it may be idealistically more desirable to bring him to Eretz Yisrael, at the same time, we know that it's cheaper to sustain where they are. So we do not take an ideological stance on this issue. We believe in supporting Jews where they are. Several years ago, we provided subsidies for fuel because it was an unusually cold winter, and we knew that the elderly were not able to pay for heating fuel and the extra kind of winter supplies that they needed. So there are times when it may be even costlier. I believe that's an individual decision and a very personal decision. And I'll support them wherever they are, whether they're in Israel or in Russia. While they're in Russia, we'll support them there.
So once they get here, your organization continues to deal with people who are in Israel now?
A very large piece of the Rockland Foundation's mission statement is the elderly here in Israel, and we have various programs, including subsidies for chronic medication, which oftentimes is elderly people cannot afford to pay for. We subsidize that. Much of our work not only in the former Soviet Union, but also some of our project in Israel are actually projects which are run by, administered by the American Joint Distribution, the JDC. our work here also here in Israel also includes children who are living on the edge, meaning the dropout amongst immigrant youth is of concern to us. Remedial tutorial reading and school readiness is an issue, particularly as it concerns immigrant youth. And so we have a sizable investment in seeing that Ethiopian children can make the grade so that they can keep up in their class levels. We feel very strongly that if we can nip in the bud the failures, the educational failures, then we can ensure success later on. So we do that with immigrant youth. We try to sustain them in the school and programs which will help to reduce the number of fallout from at high school grades, trying to retain them within educational structures. So that is really our main emphasis when it comes to social welfare. Young kids, school-age kids, helping Ethiopians get a foothold in higher education by providing scholarships, particularly in the PhD, trying to hopefully debunk the myth that Ethiopians can't learn. So we're very proud to have a PhD candidate in biophysics at the Technion. We have someone who is doing physics at the Weizmann Institute and mathematics. Both are PhD candidates. We're very proud of them. And then we do the hardcore kind of stuff. For several years now, we've been involved in food and the issues of nutritional insecurity, which has its dire consequences in type 2 diabetes, because kids are not having the right kind of nutrition, they're not eating the right kind of foods. And from there, we've gone to participating in what we believe will be one of the first model for a food bank here in Israel, where all the different feeding programs will be able to buy food collectively and with a national distribution. We've helped to map out the needs and the ways by which we will be delivering food to those who are victimized by lack of proper nutrition. From there, we've taken a very strong stand in poverty, because we realize ultimately that food is a Band-Aid. God knows that Israel has enough food, and all the Jewish organizations that are raising funds for soup kitchens should be well appraised of the situation. You know, read my lips. It's not about food. It's about poverty. And food is a Band-Aid approach. We are looking for the long term, trying to change the culture of impoverishment by providing not only vocational rehabilitation, improving one's skills and one's productivity and viability in the job market, but at the same time, excuse me, trying to find ways in which we also help the family educationally. Someone who is impoverished also has healthcare needs. Besides healthcare needs, there are issues that have to do with language skills. Many of these are immigrants who came here because of the pressure of work. They did not complete their Hebrew workshops and are unable to become integrated because of language limitations. A lot of them have trouble balancing their checkbooks or even going into a supermarket and buying the right kind of foods within the budget that they're able to buy. So all these is a kind of a holistic approach, a systemic way of dealing with the culture of impoverishment rather than doing it piecemeal. So this is one of our new directions and something I'm very excited about. I'm declaring war on poverty because we now have three generations of poor people in Israel, and it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace because we haven't really dealt with it other than by putting on a Band-Aid on the problem.
Do you see much of a difference, or do you work through a difference between the Russian immigrants and the Ethiopian immigrants, or can you share the same programs?
Well, it's interesting to see it in perspective. I mean, I remember sitting in a living room of a family that had just come from Kwara, a family that I met several years ago in their village, inside their tuco, as we sat on the floor of a mud hut made of mud bricks, and they made coffee for us. And I remember the experience of sitting in their living room when they had just gotten all of their immigrant rights, and the first thing they did was they purchased a television. They took it out of the box, they plugged it in. The whole family and extended family sat on the couch, and I sat on the side so that I could see both the screen and the family's reaction. And the sheer excitation of seeing a travelogue on Africa and having this sigh of recognition and looking at, at various wild animals, and actually like wanting to touch the screen and see whether, whether that's interactive. I think the closest analogy that one can make is by understanding that we brought the Ethiopian Jews out of Ethiopia, and the ones, particularly the ones from Kwara, were so isolated that when the first white people got to them, they tried to rub the skin to see if it would rub off. In this village in Kwara, there were two tools made of metal. There were basically two knives. And as they explained it, one knife was for cutting, for circumcision, and they say cutting people. And the second knife was for cutting animals, which was for their ritual slaughtering, for kashrut. And besides that, all the other tools were stone. So you have to imagine that these people came at Iron Age I, or the latter part of the Stone Age, and were catapulted into the 21st century. Imagine the mind travel that they have to do in order to be here and present. I mean, it's to me, it's something that's very hard to conceive how you do that mentally. Whereas the Russians have come from a oppressive society, albeit, but at the same time, you could see the Bolshoi Ballet for $5. You could see some of you could see some of the great dancers and some of the great musicians who the viola player who just passed away, Rostropovich. You could see Rostropovich for $5-6. And today, of course, culture in Russia is very expensive. You can't afford. So the Russians came here with tremendous amount of culture. Even the ones that came from small towns, there was enough traveling and local culture, and art and music to give them a world view into not only the outside world but into the classics. And these were people that were at least were familiar with something of modernity. So to try to equate their integration with the integration of the Ethiopian community is not a it's on a scale of things that doesn't really it doesn't even out, doesn't match. The Ethiopians need things that are very specific and very unique to their needs, and the Russians with their skills need to have it upgraded. But you know, you're upgrading menial workers into something more sellable, whereas you're taking basically a technologically advanced society and trying to shore up trying to bring them up to the 21st century. In other words, trying to upgrade their skills, you know, within their field. It's a very different kind of an approach.
How do you evaluate the process so far, where things stand today with the Russians, with the Ethiopians?
The Russians are extremely malleable and flexible in their needs and their ability to survive and their ability to integrate. I think the Russian integration, by and large, has been a successful one. Not every engineer remains an engineer. And the idea that that Israel can absorb 50,000 engineers is something which we long time gave up the thinking that we could do that. So people either retrained and retooled, or they lowered their expectations. But I think that on a large scale, and if you were to make a study of their attitudes concerning Aliyah, they may not be 100% satisfied with their work situation or their achievement, but they certainly have integrated very well. They've maintained their own cultural byways and their own language, and perhaps their extended families have remained intact, more so than the Ethiopians, who've been displaced by geography. The Russians have all been integrated, it seems to me, far better than the Ethiopians, for obvious reasons.
And outside of, or alongside of, the poverty issue, what other issues do you see your organization dealing with in the future? What are the needs coming?
Well, as I started to say before, I think today, if I was to pick my battles for where there's a nonprofit foundation that's dedicated to helping solve Israel's issues, I would say that my battle today is really poverty and the economic standings of and equal opportunity for all citizens is really a major concern. Our role is to jumpstart programs to force policy upon the government. For the short term, it's certainly not to supplant government's responsibilities. It's to and for sure not to dictate policy, but to point out that this needs to happen and this needs to take place, and to demonstrate that it does, and then to back off and move on to the next issue. I think that's the role of foundations, and that's really what we've been doing.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Joe Schoenwald. Lulu.